Translation, that Ananta Shesh is the devotee incarnation of Godhead. He knows nothing but service to Lord Krishna. Please repeat, that Ananta Shesh is the devotee incarnation of Godhead. He knows nothing but service to Lord Krishna. Purport. Srila Jiva Goswami in his Krishna Sandarbha has described Sheshanaga as follows. Sri Ananta Dev has thousands of faces and is fully independent. Always ready to serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he waits upon him constantly. Sankarshan is the first expansion of Vasudev, and because he appears by his own will, he is called Svarat, fully independent. He is therefore infinite and transcendental to all limits of time and space. He himself appears as the thousand-headed Shesha. In the Skanda Purana, in the Ayodhya Mahatmya chapter, the demigod Indra requested Lord Shesha, who was standing before him as Lakshman, please go to your eternal abode, Vishnu Loka, where your expansion Shesha with his serpentine hoods is also present. After thus dispatching Lakshman to the regions of Patala, Lord Indra returned to his abode. This quotation indicates that the Sankarshan of the quadruple form descends with Lord Ram as Lakshman. When Lord Ram disappears, Shesha again separates himself from the personality of Lakshman. Shesha then returns to his own abode in the Patala regions, and Lakshman returns to his abode in Vaikuntha. The Lagu Bhagavatamrita gives the following description. The Sankarshan of the second group of quadruple forms appears as Ram, taking with him Shesha, who bears the global spheres. There are two features of Shesha. One is the bearer of the globes, and the other is the bedstead servitor. I'll read that again. One is the bearer of globes, and the other is the bedstead servitor. The Shesha who bears the globes is a potent incarnation of Sankarshan, and therefore he is sometimes called Sankarshan. The bedstead feature of Shesha always presents himself as an eternal servitor of the Lord. Seta Ananta Shesha Bhakta Avatara Ishvarera Seva Vina Nahi Janiyara. That Ananta Shesha is the devotee incarnation of Godhead. He knows nothing but service to Lord Krishna. Om Ajnana Timaranda Shaginanjana Shalakya Chakshir Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Panchatatvatmakam Krishnam Bhakta Rupa Swarupakam Bhaktavataram Bhaktakyam Namami Bhakta Shaktikam Panchakalpa Tripyascha Kripa Sindhubya Eva Cha Patitanam Pavani Bhyo Vaishnavi Bhyo Namo Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhunichananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasari Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So the chapter is called The Glories of Lord Nityananda Balaram. And the Acharyas have made it very clear that without the mercy of Lord Nityananda, one cannot obtain Radha Krishna. Henoni taibini bai Radha Krishna paitinai. Narottam Das Thakur states this. So in order to instill proper respect to Lord Nityananda, who is Lord Balaram, and not consider him an ordinary person, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami has spent most of this chapter describing how Lord Nityananda is Avatamsha, the source of all incarnations, how the various Vishnu Tattva expansions are coming from Lord Nityananda. And the chapter will conclude with a warning that if one disrespects Lord Nityananda, then one will fall down. And the example is given of the brother of Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, the author of this book. He had no faith in Lord Nityananda, and therefore he fell from the spiritual platform that he was on. And it said, Dui Bai Eko Tana Tanu Samana Prakash. The two brothers are actually one body. Don't try and separate them. So it's very important that we understand the position of Lord Nityananda. So we've been discussing how from Lord Balaram comes the first Chaturvyuha, then comes Lord Narayan, then comes the second Chaturvyuha, and then at this point we cross over the boundary between the material and the spiritual world, and the further expansions are present in embassies of the spiritual world present in the material world, namely the Karanadaka Shai Vishnu, the Garbhadaka Shai Vishnu, and the Kshirodaka Shai Vishnu. They're all existing beyond the spiritual realm, but they're still in the spiritual realm because they're never touched by Maya. Maya Tita Guna Tita Vishnu Paramesh. Vishnu is never under the influence of the modes of material nature. So it's described that this the spiritual world, the topmost planet is Goloka Vrindavan. And then we have, which is itself is divided into Krishna Loka, Mathura and Dvarka. And beyond this or below this, there are innumerable Vaikuntha planets where the various quadruple expansions reside. Now the way that they hold the various symbols, the conch, the club, the disc and the lotus, varies from one incarnation to another. But we should understand that these unlimited Vishnu forms are all coming from the Chaturvyuha. Now the boundary of the spiritual realm is called Brahmaloka, which is the impersonal feature of the Supreme and the bodily effulgence of Krishna. Said Advaitam Brahmapanishadi Tadabhyasya Tanubha. That the... Speak louder. Okay, it must be the kitchen. The kitchen thing should be up. It's okay. I don't understand. I'm speaking normal, but I will try my best. Okay. I thought he was telling me the time was up. I was like, oh, really, already? So, yeah. So we're discussing the Brahmaloka as the impersonal feature. Now, it said that beyond that is the Karana Samudra, or the ocean, the causal ocean. So this is beyond the impersonal feature. And then within the causal ocean is Karanadaka Shai Vishnu, from the pores of whose body emanate so many universes. Vishnu is known as Avataravali Beach. He is the source of unlimited universes. No, that's actually source of unlimited incarnations. He's Koti Brahmanda Vigraha, the source of unlimited universes. And then within each universe, Garbhadaka Shai Vishnu expands and he creates, and then he enters into each universe within every atom and within the hearts of all living entities as Kshirodaka Shai Vishnu. Now this Kshirodaka Shai Vishnu, appears to be expanded into many, but actually he is one. This is explained in the Bhagavad Gita. So he is one, therefore there is a planet in this universe called Shvetadvip, where Kshirodaka Shai Vishnu resides, but he's also residing with everyone's heart. So the example may be given, and Prabhupada gives this example, that you may ask of anyone, where is the sun? They will all say, oh, the sun is above my head. So it appears that the sun is above Afghanistan, the sun is above Britain, the sun is everywhere at once. So it appears to be in many places, but actually the sun is in one place. So in the same way, we understand Kshirodaka Shai Vishnu is one, and yet he is many. That may explain why it is said, there's a contradiction in the previous chapter, I think it's in the previous chapter. In one place it's said that Kshirodaka Shai Vishnu is eternal, and in another place it is said that Kshirodaka Shai Vishnu is not eternal. Now if we consider the individual pencil-like effulgences, they are not eternal. Like if you go back to the spiritual world, there is no longer any need for Kshirodaka Shai Vishnu to remain within your heart. So that aspect, the apparent multitude aspect of Kshirodaka Shai Vishnu is not eternal, but the one Kshirodaka Shai Vishnu is eternal. At least that's how I understand it. But if you have any different understanding, please let me know. Maybe I can correct me. Someone's nodding, someone agrees. Okay, let's hope. So from this Kshirodaka Shai Vishnu, actually before we mention this, one point should be understood, that there are two Shvetadvips. Now previously in this chapter, Shvetadvip is given as a synonym for Vrindavan, Braj, Gokul, and Goloka. So Krishna's planet is called Shvetadvip, but also there's a Shvetadvip in this material universe. Actually, in every material universe, there is a Shvetadvip, and that is a different planet. It means the milk ocean, so we shouldn't be confused by the two. Now, from Kshirodakshaya Vishnu, there is the expansion, the servitor expansion, Sheshanag. Now, he's given the name Shesha because he has found the limit of service. His service cannot be surpassed. Therefore, he has found the limit. And he's known as Ananta because his service is unlimited. So the term Ananta Shesh means limited and unlimited simultaneously. His service is unlimited and he has found the limit of service. Therefore, Lord Nityananda is the original guru. The guru is that person who has found the limit of service to Krishna. He can't surpass the guru. And all bona fide representatives of Lord Nityananda, they are bona fide acharyas, and they are empowered by Lord Nityananda. Therefore, you don't need to worry that the guru is a jiva tattva, because the guru is empowered. He's a representative of Lord Nityananda. Therefore, whatever potency Lord Nityananda wishes to manifest through the guru, Lord Nityananda is perfectly able to do that and will do that. So that brings us to Sheshanag. Now, the two purports I read, one was describing how the planets are situated on the hoods. Lord Shesha has unlimited hoods, and the planets are just like mustard seeds, and they carry no weight. So in the purport, Prabhupada explains that, if I'll read it exactly, the scientist's law of gravity is a partial explanation of Lord Sankarshan's energy. The name Sankarshan has an etymological relationship to the idea of gravity. So here Prabhupada is giving some credit to the material scientists. And you don't find that very often in Prabhupada's books. It's an exceptional purport. He's actually acknowledging that the scientist's law of gravity is a partial explanation of Lord Sankarshan's energy. Now, so the next statement is quite interesting. What is the etymological relationship between gravity and Sankarshan? Well, here's the answer I would give. At the beginning of this chapter, there is a statement that Lord Balaram is the original Sankarshan, in brackets, attracting deity. So the term Sankarshan indicates that he is the attracting deity. So he exerts a force of attraction upon our consciousness. In the same way that the material scientist's law of gravity is a law of attraction. It's a law of how mass attracts mass. That is why we're sitting on the ground. Our bodies have a certain mass, and the earth has a certain mass. Therefore, there is a force of attraction between our bodies and the center of the earth, which keeps us on the ground. Otherwise, we would spin off. So, in both cases, we have the idea of attraction. So gravity indicates attraction, and Sankarshan also indicates attraction. In the 10th canto, Lord Krishna explains to Yoga Maya, Garbha Sankarshanat Tamvai Prahu Sankarshanam Bhuve. He's explaining how Lord Balaram, who's in the womb of Devaki, will be known as Sankarshan because he will be pulled or drawn from the womb of Devaki and placed in the womb of Rohini. This was the order that Krishna gave Yogamaya. You must transfer Balaram from Devaki to Rohini. So in this connection, the term Sankarshan means to pull or to draw. It's like we have the term Krishi, which means ploughing. Karshana means ploughing as well. We're reading the 7th canto at the moment. So Karshana means to plough the fields, to till the soil. And actually the connection, there's also a connection with the term Krishna, which means attractive. So Sankarshan can mean pulling or pulling towards oneself. Both meanings are there. Later on, Garga Muni, during the name-giving ceremony, he gives a different meaning for Sankarshan. He says, if I can remember how it goes, Yadu nam apritak bhavad Sankarshanam ushanchapi. He will be known as Sankarshan because he will attract. Ushanti means attract. That's the word for word. He will unite the families of Nanda Maharaj and the families of Vasudev. So because Lord Balaram unites everyone, or because he attracts everyone, he's known as Sankarshan. So both meanings are given, whether it's he's been transferred, Sankarshan in that sense, or whether Sankarshan in the sense of he's the attracting deity. So both meanings are there. And it's interesting how in English we have a similar word connection. We have the term tractor, which pulls, and attractor, pulls towards oneself. Now, apparently in German, there's a similar connection, but I don't know the German connection. But anyway, if anyone knows German, they can maybe explain the similarity between attraction and traction, the two words. It's all connected. Sanskrit is the mother of all languages. So we're mentioning here how he's the mustard seeds. They carry no weight. So because Sankarshan is the origin of the law of gravity, then the law of gravity will not hinder Sankarshan in any way. So therefore, as Sankarshan is in his expansion as an Antashesh, he carries the hoods. And as Shiva Maharaj pointed out, he's so strong that it carries no weight. He's not like Atlas. We have the idea of the strong man Atlas carrying the universe. So he's shaking and sweating under the effort of that. So Krishna and all his avatars there, they can effortlessly perform those activities without feeling any hindrance. Therefore, there is the contradictory statement in the Bhagavad Gita, Matstani Sarvabhutani, all living beings are situated in me, and Nacha Matstani Bhutani, they are not situated in me. So the meaning is, although they are situated, he feels no hindrance at all. Therefore, he remains aloof. So this is the potency of Krishna that the living entities do not have. We cannot carry something and remain aloof at the same time. We have to exert some effort and we feel some burden. But for Krishna, he can simultaneously carry the burden and at the same time have no burden whatsoever. This is the potency of Krishna. So I thought I would discuss a little bit about the material scientists. Because as I pointed out, in today's verse, today's purport, they are given some credit that they have a partial understanding of the energy of Sankarshan. So as I mentioned, this is unusual for Prabhupada to give credit to material scientists. His main focus was in pointing out the defect of modern science and how modern science is misleading the general public. It's quite interesting. I did a little bit of research. There have been many studies on the religious beliefs of scientists. And what they found is, generally, scientists are more likely to be atheists than the general public. They're all also more likely to believe in the theory of evolution than the general public. Actually, the theory of evolution does not have so many believers. There was one study found that 17% of America firmly believe in evolution, Darwin's evolution. That is all, only 17%. Now, many of them have a partial belief. They think maybe it's true. But to consider that only 17% believe it to be fully undoubtedly true, that's not very many. But among scientists, it's something like 70%. So you see a vast difference in what they believe. And then when you look at prominent scientists, they are even more atheistic. There was one study that showed that 25% of scientists are atheists, firm atheists, but then 7% of prominent scientists are firm atheists. Of those, a lot of scientists, there were the firm atheists, there were those that believed in a higher force, but not in a personal God. and they were something like 50%. And those who believe in a personal God, well, amongst prominent scientists, it was low. It was something like 20%. But amongst scientists in general, it was about around 40%. But then when you look at the general public, it's the majority actually believe in a personal God. I forget the percentages. But the percentages don't matter so much because every study had vastly different answers. But the common thread was scientists are more atheistic. So Prabhupada would point out that they are like the modern day gurus. And he spent a lot of time debunking scientific theories. Prabhupada is, of all the people who have existed over the last few hundred years, one would have to say that Srila Prabhupada, probably more than anyone, has fought and successfully defeated material scientists. Now, I was a believer in Darwinism, and I was also an atheist. Then after reading Srila Prabhupada's books, I changed. And there are probably many people in this room who are in the same category. It is through Srila Prabhupada that they have given up the atheistic mentality of modern science, and they have lost their faith in the material scientists. Now, this is a very, very important activity to free the people in general from the grip of the modern scientists with their dogma. Now, they may say that religion is dogma, but actually they have dogma. And as it is sometimes pointed out very cleverly, that the scientists, they have blind doubt. They sometimes say that religion, people who followers of religion have blind faith. But actually, our faith isn't blind because we have a process. It is, how does it go? Bhaktir Preshanubhavo Viraktir Anyatra Chaisha Trika Eka Kalaha Prapajamanasya Yatashnatasyus Tushtih Pushtih Kshudapayo Nugasam. The Navayogendras in the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, they state that just as when we eat and we get satisfaction, nourishment and alleviation of hunger, in the same way when we practice devotional service, three things automatically happen. Our bhakti develops, our realization of the supreme develops, and we become detached from the material world. This is a very insignificant verse because it indicates that the process is scientific. In other words, as we practice, we will experience the results. In other words, we do the test and we get the result. Therefore, it's not blind faith. What we do is we act upon whatever faith we have, and then the results are in accordance with what we expect by reading scripture, and therefore our faith deepens, and therefore our practice deepens. In this way, it is a scientific process. So that is, it is not blind faith, it is faith with vision. Now, the scientists, on the other hand, they will dismiss bhakti yoga without even trying it. Therefore, because they have not tried it, their doubt is blind. They have not given it the proper test. It is like when, if I were to say to a scientist, study bacteria, and here's a magnifying glass, then the scientist will say, I cannot study bacteria because the instrument you have given me is insufficient for the purpose. Shishiradago kulananda ki jai. So all good scientists will acknowledge the fact that in order to do research in a particular subject, particular branch, one needs instruments which are sufficiently powerful. That is why for so many centuries, Newton's law of gravity was considered to be correct. The scientists had not the sufficient instruments to analyze light. When they analyzed the nature of light, they discovered that light was the same, traveled at the same speed, regardless of its apparent speed through the ether. They actually believed that light travels through ether, so they did an experiment to see how fast the ether how fast the earth was moving through the ether. They expected that they were bouncing beams of light off mirrors to see which, if you swim upstream and you swim downstream, it takes longer than if you swim horizontal back and forth. Actually, I can't remember which way around it is. But anyway, when you do the calculation, they were expecting to see a difference, but there was no difference. Therefore, they said, well, either there's no ether, or they said that, well, length must contract as you move. Therefore, Einstein's theories of relativity have length contracting and mass changes, time changes, and all kinds of strange implications. But scientists had no inclination about this because the instruments that they used weren't sufficiently powerful until it was around the 1900s that these experiments were performed. Therefore, one needs powerful instruments to study modern-day science, or like quantum mechanics and relativity, etc. So it's the same with Bhakti Yoga. We need very powerful senses in order to experience Krishna. Atashi Krishna Namadi Nabhavet Grahyam Indriyai Sivam Mukhi Hijivadau Swayam Eva Spirachada. Krishna cannot be understood with the dull material senses, but when one engages in service, then he will reveal himself. So these are the instruments that we use. So if you tell a scientist the instruments are service to Krishna, scientists will not be interested. Therefore, their doubt is blind. So that's the difference. I'll say a little bit about today's, that was yesterday, that was 119 purport. Today's purport, interesting statement about Lord Ram and Lakshman. He's indicating that when Lakshman was present on this earth, Shesha was there within Lakshman. So Shesha returns to his own abode and separates himself from the personality of Lakshman. So this is an interesting point, and it explains a lot of apparent contradictions in the scriptures. One example is this, that Nanda and Yashoda are said to be Nitya Siddha, and yet we have the statement that in previous life they were Drona and Dara. And who else were they? Kashyapa and Aditi, is that right? Or Prishni and Sutapa. Anyway, there's a progression of incarnations that take fulfillment in Yashoda and Nanda Maharaj. So how then can they be said to be Nitya Siddhas? And the answer is indicated indirectly in this purport. Because when incarnations appear, sometimes many personalities are present at the same time. So we have Shesha and Lakshman, they're present in the same body. And at the end of the pastime, Lakshman returns to Ayodhya in the spiritual sky, and Shesha returns to Patala Loka. So in the same way Nanda and Yashoda are doing their pastimes, then there may be many, one or many sadhana siddha devotees who are present experiencing life in the same body as Nanda and Yashoda, even though Nanda and Yashoda are Nitya Siddha. So sometimes we read, like for example, that the Yadu dynasty are Nitya Siddha, but in other places it's described that they were like envious of Krishna, therefore they weren't allowed to leave their bodies in Dwarka. Therefore Krishna arranged for them to go to Prabhas and to kill each other after taking intoxication. So in this way we see that these sort of contradictory statements. The Yadu dynasty, they're both pure devotees and they're not pure devotees. Sometimes it's said that they are Nitya Siddhas, other times it's said that they returned to their posts as devas in the heavenly planets, you see. So it may be the case that, like Nanda and Yashoda, like for the Yadu dynasty, there may be several personalities present in their bodies at the same time. So these are some considerations.